the first installment that will recapitalize our nation's fleet of vice breakers.
The Coast Guard makes plans for ramping up Arctic operations. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 1st. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, Alaska State Troopers say they need more officers.
I think we're doing the best we can, but we don't have adequate funding or staffing that we need to provide public safety to the citizens of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Coast Guard Commandant Paul Zunkuft broke some Arctic news in his annual State of the Coast Guard address today. The Admiral says the Coasties have a huge mission in the Arctic and need the right tools to get the job done.
And that is why I am pleased to announce that very soon, I mean real soon, I'm talking tomorrow, we will release a request for proposal with the support of both the administration and Congress to acquire the first heavy icebreaker.
Over several years, Congress committed millions of dollars towards an icebreaker, which could cost as much as $1 billion. The U.S. now has only one heavy icebreaker that's operational, the Polar Star. The Coast Guard is projected to need as many as six. In his speech, Zunkuft suggested the request for proposals coming Friday is an early step.
The first installment that will recapitalize our nation's fleet of vice breakers. Yes, the Coast Guard is back.
This was the Admiral's last State of the Coast Guard speech. He's due to retire this summer. A bill passed by the Alaska Senate today would allow car insurers to use credit histories to determine premium rates when customers renew their policies. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the floor debate.
Until 2003, insurers in Alaska were barred from using credit histories to determine how much customers would pay. That year, the state allowed them to start using these records for new applicants, but they still couldn't use them for people who were renewing policies. House Bill 195 would allow the companies to begin to use these histories for renewals. Anchorage Republican Senator Mia Costello says the bill would allow those with good credit to pay lower, quote, preferred, end quote, rates.
Like it or not, credit scores are actually an indicator of risk, and so this is what that insurance is entirely based on.
Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski opposed the bill. He pointed to a 2003 state report that found that areas with low income and minority Alaskans would pay more.
Everyone will have people in their district who will suffer if this bill passes. The working poor will suffer, minorities will suffer, those in rural Alaska will suffer, seniors will suffer.
Willikowski says auto insurance premiums should be based on people's driving records. He quoted research by Consumer Reports magazine.
In the vast amount of states that allow the use of credit scores, a poor credit history will have a greater impact on your auto insurance premium than a drunk driving conviction.
Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki voted for the bill. He notes that new insurance consumers have been affected by similar rules for 15 years.
I represent all Alaskans in my district, not just the underprivileged. We're talking about this in a way almost as though it hasn't been the law of the land for many years that credit history is used.
The legislature passed a similar bill 2 years ago. Governor Bill Walker vetoed it. But Walker introduced the new version, which includes more consumer protections than the earlier bill. For example, the new bill requires insurers to notify consumers that there are a series of exemptions allowing some consumers to not have their credit histories used. those exemptions include people who have had serious injuries, divorces, or unemployment that lasts at least 3 months from involuntary terminations. In addition, when people appeal the use of their credit histories, the State Division of Insurance will be able to decide on the appeal. In the bill Governor Walker vetoed, the insurer would have ruled on the appeal. The Senate voted 13-4 to pass the bill, with Willikowski and three fellow Democrats, Tom Begich, Dennis Egan, and Berta Gardner, the only noes. Senators Lyman Hoffman, Shelley Hughes, and Gary Stevens were absent. The House passed the bill 39-0 last year. Nikiski Republican Mike Chenault was absent. The bill now heads to Walker's desk. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Alaska State Troopers are at critically low staffing levels. That's according to a report from the Department of Public Safety. Budget cuts have trimmed the number of trooper positions across the state, but the department is also struggling to keep troopers in the positions that are funded. The report says troopers are leaving for better pay and retirement elsewhere, and low staffing is hurting the agency's ability to respond to calls for help. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports.
It's a Saturday night in Wasilla, and I'm riding in Trooper Lee Phillips' patrol vehicle.
I really enjoy what I do. You know, believe it or not, this might sound corny, but I really enjoy helping people.
Dozens of teenagers are reportedly drinking and fighting at a party, and a neighbor just fired a gun into the air to try to break it up. Phillips flips on his flashing lights, and a quick warning to drivers listening to this, you're about to hear his siren.
Sometimes they start ganging up on one kid, kicking him in the head, you know, I mean, weapons start getting pulled out, so the sooner we get there, the better.
We're doing 90 miles an hour, and I have to admit, it's kind of a thrill. But not every call tonight has been this exciting. Phillips has pulled over some cars, stopped to direct traffic past a wreck, and counseled a woman after a domestic disturbance. It's not all lights and sirens, but it all takes patience and time. And on some nights, the troopers don't have as much time to deal with anything except the highest priority calls.
You're just call to call to call to call, and you know, it's like dispatch is like, hey, can you break soon? We got an assault pending, you know. So, you know, that's frustrating when you can't do your job to the best of your ability because there's so much other calls pending because of lack of manpower.
Phillips worries things could get worse, and he's not the only one.
We are in a crisis. We're struggling to make this work.
That's Doug Massey, a 20-year wildlife trooper and president of the union that represents the troopers.
I think we're doing the best we can, but we don't have adequate funding or staffing that we need to provide public safety to the citizens of Alaska.
Massey points to the numbers. Roughly 10% of trooper positions statewide are unfilled. The rate of troopers leaving for other jobs has nearly doubled. Most go to other law enforcement agencies.
They are definitely bargain hunting. They're looking for the best pay, the best benefits, and what the department has to offer them. So they're more willing to separate and go a different direction.
And it's not easy training new troopers. A tiny fraction of applicants make it through the process. It takes up to a year and a half and nearly $200,000 to train one trooper. To keep the ones they already have, the Department of Public Safety Retention Plan report suggests returning Alaska law enforcement officers to a defined benefit retirement plan. That's what they used to offer, and it guaranteed a certain level of retirement benefits after 20 years of employment. The defined contribution plan state employees currently get is an investment account that can be cashed out in full after just 5 years. Lieutenant Derek DeGraff heads the Troopers Recruitment Office, which is now increasingly focused on retention as well.
So we moved the finish line essentially to 5 years. I heard it said many years ago when we switched over to this, give us 5 years and that's adequate. And it's just not, it's just really costly. It becomes more of a revolving door.
DeGraff says police departments at the same job fairs he attends in the lower 48, hoping to stop attrition and become more attractive to recruits, have returned to defined benefit plans.
The cost after losing that with the revolving door and the training and the lack of police services to the public became such an issue that they brought them back.
That argument may have gained traction in the Alaska legislature. A recent bill by Senate President Pete Kelly, a Republican from Fairbanks, would allow police officers, troopers, and firefighters to return to a defined benefit plan. Kelly says a cost analysis still needs to be done.
And the numbers need to be compelling, or the legislature probably won't do it. But I think we actually can find that those numbers do produce a benefit to the state of Alaska. And that remains to be seen. We haven't had that work done yet, but the bill is filed.
That bill would only affect public safety employees. Senator Dennis Egan, a Juneau Democrat, and others say all public employees, including teachers and state workers, should be in the same larger pool, which he says would keep down the cost. Egan also has a bill filed that would give public employees the option of going with defined benefits. But Massey, the troopers' union president, says that if it comes down to a higher price tag, the state should prioritize public safety and the dangerous daily conditions of law enforcement work.
When anyone asks, what makes you think you're different? My answer is we are, period.
25 to me.
Back on patrol, Trooper Lee Phillips has wrapped up at the party. A couple other troopers responded. They investigated some possible underage drinking, but if there was a fight, nobody got hurt. Phillips says tonight the trooper numbers were adequate, but that's not always the case. If he'd been alone, he would have been outnumbered 100-1.
That is right there as a prime reason that when we're shorthanded, it's just not good. Because say someone has a prisoner, and someone else is out on another call, and someone's on a death investigation, and then it's just one trooper going to deal with this whole thing. You know, it's not a safe situation for anybody.
While Phillips and his fellow troopers continue to work to meet the daily demand, the legislature will examine the costs associated with the bills by Senators Kelly and Egan, as well as the cost to public safety if troopers continue to leave. On the outskirts of Wasilla, I'm Casey Grove.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an art project draws attention to missing and murdered Alaska Native women.
It's opening a conversation that has to be had by families, by law enforcement.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting starting at 10 a.m. on March 5th and 9 a.m. on March 6th at the Nome Mini Convention Center. More at 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
If one had to choose a theme for Lisa Murkowski's roundtable discussions on the Tongass National Forest, it would be access. Over and over, the senator and U.S. Forest Service chief Tony Took heard panelists say they need more access to the forest, through roads and through less cumbersome permitting, among other things. KRBD's Layla Carey attended the nearly three-hour-long discussion Friday in Ketchikan and has this story.
There were two panels because there were so many panelists. They represented a wide variety of interests. A few environmental groups were invited, along with Sea Alaska Native Corporation's Jaylene Kukesh. But the panels did lean toward industry, commerce, and state and local governments. Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mayor David Landis, for example, told Forest Service Chief Took that the borough is more than 96% Forest Service land, with just a tiny amount available for development and taxation. Landis says that historically that was okay because of all the jobs available on national land, most notably timber. But he says those jobs went away as the Forest Service started limiting the timber supply. In response, Congress provided payments in lieu of taxes and secure rural schools payments. But now those amounts are seeing cuts too.
And that distresses us, certainly, and we're finding ways to fill those holes. But to be honest, we would rather have the jobs back.
Another recurring theme for many panelists was the plan for transitioning to a young-growth timber industry. The Forest Service went through a long process to come up with a transition plan that calls for a complete switch in 15 years. Timber industry representatives have said and continue to say that's not feasible. Bryce Dahlstrom is from Viking Lumber on Prince of Wales Island. He says instead of switching from one to another, a solution would be to allow both, because his mill just can't process young growth and never will. Dahlstrom gave an analogy.
You know, I put it towards a fishing boat, that you have your crew that you fish salmon all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, well, you can't catch salmon anymore, you got to catch halibut.
Some of the conservationists on the panel, though, say the transition plan was the result of a great collaborative effort that shouldn't be discounted. Andrew Tomes is with the Sitka Conservation Society and was a member of the Tongass Advisory Committee. The TAC came up with the blueprint for transitioning to second growth.
I would say that the recommendations that we made are one of the best blueprints for a viable approach to Tongass management, and the recommendations are the assemblage of a huge wealth of experience and knowledge from people on the Tongass who work with the agency and with other stakeholders and landowner groups.
Other panelists talked about the need to protect fish streams and fisheries in general. Still others talked about the need to build electric utility infrastructure and how challenging the federal permit process is for that work. After the discussion, Took says he'll take what he heard back to Washington, D.C. for more discussions with the Secretary of Agriculture. He says he was listening for common themes such as access and proposed solutions such as a slower transition for young growth. Took says he heard about the quantity of young growth that would be needed to keep a mill running and...
I heard about timing around permitting. You know, these are not just the big scale issues, but some of the smaller ones. I also heard a lot about using science and using data that seemed to be really important to people, no matter who they were. But we have really well-informed decisions.
Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Wildfires in the lower 48 are affecting what the federal government can do in the Tongass and other national forests. U.S. Forest Service official Chris French told Southeast Alaska leaders his agency is spending more and more money on firefighting.
We've seen 8,000 positions across the agency that we have essentially shifted from either providing services, forest management, recreation management, to essentially fire suppression.
French said firefighting is expected to use up about 60% of the Forest Service budget within a few years. That's 3 to 4 times what it was 15 years ago. He said his agency is also spending more time and money responding to floods, droughts, diseases, and insect infestations. He didn't speak about climate change, but many scientists have said that's the reason behind such extreme events. French, the agency's associate deputy chief, addressed the Southeast Conference mid-session summit in Juneau last month. He also said he's looking at ways to speed up the agency's permitting process. He said it has a backlog of more than 6,600 special use permits.
This includes permitting outfitter guides, folks that are coming to us asking for access to mines or permitting ski areas or even range allotment permits.
He said the agency is looking at excluding more types of projects from extensive environmental assessments. That will include an analysis of prior reviews under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Last year, the Kodiak Electric Association received a permit to extend its Terror Lake hydroelectric project, and it's now selected a contractor. The expansion would catch snowmelt and rain and transport it to the Terror Lake Reservoir to increase its energy capacity. According to a KEA press release, the installment should boost the annual hydropower production by about 33 million kilowatt hours, which is roughly 25% more energy. The contractor, Kiewit, is the same company that built the original Terror Lake hydroelectric facility in the 1980s. As stated in the release, KEA planned for the diversion during the initial construction in the 80s, but the extra leg of the project was considered unnecessarily pricey for the need at the time. Kiewit is scheduled to start construction in June, and the diversion should be up and running by fall of 2020. Scientists have confirmed what Indigenous people have known for centuries. The wind influences the travel of northern fur seal pups. As Alaska's Energy Desk's Zoe Sobel reports, this research could help scientists get a clearer picture of environmental factors that may play a role in the mysterious decline of the species.
In the late 1800s, the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury sent Captain C.L. Hooper to the Pribilof Islands to learn as much as he could about the northern fur seal from the Alaska Native people who lived there. At the time, the fur trade was big business. One of the lessons he recorded was that the seals are known to travel with the wind when possible. Now scientists have the data to back up that traditional knowledge.
We have this amazing technology that really allows us this very cool look at the lives of an individual animal and where it goes and what it does.
Noel Pelland is a physical oceanographer at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center.
That's helping us to quantify some of these things that have been discussed by the Aleut hunters.
Pelland is studying how climate affects the survival of northern fur seals in the Bering Sea, and wind may be an important factor. After pups leave the Pribilof Islands in late fall, they can migrate thousands of miles. Varying wind conditions mean pups can end up in a range of locations, from the Aleutian Islands to the Gulf of Alaska. Pelland wants to know if the way the pups migrate and where they end up is affecting their survival.
In the best years, about 50% of the pups who leave on their migration will make it to age two. In the worst years, only about 20% will make it through their migration.
So far, Pelland and his colleagues have compared data from satellite-tagged pups with weather models. Now they want to compare year-to-year changes in the survival of the pups with where the pups end up. And he says the research helps make the case for all scientists to take traditional knowledge into account.
There's this idea of a separation between quote-unquote scientific knowledge and traditional knowledge, and I think a much better way to look at that is as a continuum, really, you know, that there isn't this real formal separation. It's all knowledge.
Wind might not be a factor in the fur seal decline, Pelland says, but better understanding its role is important. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Ketchikan High School's academic decathlon team won the state championship in Anchorage last weekend, and now they will be headed to the national competition in April. Coach Peter Stanton says this is the first year Ketchikan's team won at state.
We weren't counting on it, but we definitely felt that after the results last year, where there were a lot of juniors on the team who were very hardworking, high-scoring, passionate, and then getting second place last year, we definitely felt like we had a great chance to win it all this year.
Stanton says that for about 15 years, it seemed two Fairbanks schools, West Valley and Lathrop, traded the championship back and forth. He says Lathrop won the two times Ketchikan took second place, including last year.
And so that, you know, that really stuck with us, that we still needed to beat Lathrop.
And this year, Stanton says Lathrop came in second. This year's academic decathlon theme was Africa. Stanton says team members received their materials for that theme last May and started studying over the summer.
The literature event required the students to read Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe and then several other short stories and poems from African authors. And then the science events, they learned about HIV, Ebola, malaria, and other infectious diseases. In social science, they learned about the history of West Africa, and then they also had art and music focusing on all sorts of African art and African music.
Eight Ketchikan team members will travel to Texas in April for the national competition. Stanton says he will have each team member focus their studies on their favorite event in hopes of winning a medal.
And it is going to be very tough competition. Every event is scored out of 1,000 points, and the tests are usually pretty difficult. In order to win a medal, they're probably going to need to get, 90-plus percent of the questions correct.
Stanton says he's proud of all the students for their hard work and for making history. Stanton is a Ketchikan grad and a former Academic Decathlon team member. This is his fourth year coaching the team since returning to Ketchikan as a teacher. An Alaska Native artist is using her work to draw attention to the plight of missing and murdered Alaska Native women. Homicide is a leading cause of death of American women under 44, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is especially true for American Indian and Alaska Native women, who experience the second highest rate of homicide of any race or ethnicity. KDLG's Avery Lill has more on how Amber Webb is drawing portraits to remember women who are missing or have been murdered, and to honor their memories and start conversations.
Alaska Native artist Amber Webb hand-stitched an oversized cusbook from white cotton sheets she bought at a thrift store. In permanent marker, she drew the faces of Alaska Native women who have been murdered or who are missing. Webb lives in Anchorage. She's originally from Dillingham. Six of the women featured on the cusbook are from Bristol Bay, four from Dillingham, one from Aleknagik, and one from Manicotic. Webb said that the plight of several area women in particular inspired her to create her work of art.
Valerie Ziftoff, she's still missing, and I know her family is still looking for answers about her disappearance. And then Lori D. Wilson as well. When I was young, my family spent a lot of time with Val's aunts, and I think as a kid I can remember seeing her at family functions and thinking she was so cool. You know, seeing her family try to come to terms with having lost her that way, it's had a pretty profound impact on my life.
Webb hopes that her piece will encourage more people to join the conversation about preventing violence against Native women.
It's opening a conversation that has to be had by families, by law enforcement, by the academic community, legislators. I mean, I think all of Alaska has to kind of think about it.
Webb is making arrangements for a traveling exhibit, which she hopes to display in Dillingham and Anchorage. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Casey Grove in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I am Ann Hellman. Have a lovely night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.